when you began to listen to music, let's say professionally, in terms of where you decided to head to yourself, what were the composers that were most important to you?
Well, I think the composers I listened to non-professionally were probably the most important to me, and then they became important professionally. I know at 14, a friend played the Rite of Spring for me. I had not heard any 20th century music, basically. And that made the most enormous impression on me. I think, basically, the seeds for becoming a composer were sowed that afternoon. I don't know if it would all come out the same way if I hadn't heard that when I heard it. And in that same year, I was 14, I heard the Brandenburg Concertos, I think, the fifth. And at that time, I also began listening to jazz. The piano lessons I had taken up to that time were basically the John Thompson variety, which means I was getting chopped up bits of Haydn and actually no Baroque music in its original form, and no 20th century music. So and certainly no jazz. So that the that period of time was probably kind of ear opener. It was at that time I decided to study rudimental drumming with Roland Koloff. And that certainly, in order to play drums in a jazz dance band in high school, I think that that period of time, while not that professional, I did not have the scores of any of those works until later, nevertheless was crucial. Those same tastes have stayed with me, and as recently as Tehillim, I was looking at Kreislag and Tondespond, and as a matter of fact, basically, Tehillim is a cantata. And if you listen to the alto soprano duet in cantata number 4, and you listen to my slow movement, you'll hear that is got a sort of a second cousin once removed relationship to the whole question answer, which Bach has in so many of his cantatas and in the Passions. Came out of that. The idea of doubling the voices with either oboe and English horn, which actually sounds like something out of the cantatas, or with the clarinets for contrast, was a direct steal from Bach.
Talk a little bit more about the sacra, if you can. What do you remember about specifically about your reactions when you were heard at the age of 14? And also what from that particular piece has stayed with you over the years as a sort of license to dare to move somewhere else from where people have used before.
Well, I perhaps like Boulez have admired the opening, the introduction. I admire the whole piece, and of course the danse sacrale is a great study in rhythm and particularly changing meters. I don't think I've ever really done an exhaustive analysis of the sacra. I've gone over it with score many times, but I feel there's probably still a great deal I could learn from it. I think the original hearing, it wasn't, wow, this is a whole different kind of rhythm, or this isn't a totally, totally different type of harmony. As recently as the piece I'm working on right now, I went over, I think Sam Raffling just published a one piano version of the right, and I was going over that a bit, and I was lifting some harmonies that I'm using in this Williams piece, that and lifting some stuff from Ives, Three Places in New England, just going over the voicings of chords. It's not actually it's not so much, I'll take a single chord and the Stravinsky can take off from there, I'll take a single chord from the Ives, and then with that voicing as a guide, begin to move it around the way I would like to. Certainly, in terms of actually learning techniques, I probably got more from Bartok, because when I began to study composition with Hall Overton, it was really my first teacher. After I got out of Cornell, Hall used the microcosmos as a kind of way to get back to the keyboard and a way to introduce me to the modes and canonic technique. And because there's a very clear didactic breakdown in the microcosmos of what Bartok is doing in the pieces canon, the fifth canon, unison in Dorian mode and Phrygian mode, the pieces and the techniques they suggested were very definitely applied. I spent a lot of time at Juilliard listening to the third, fourth, and fifth quartets. I remember I once did a paper comparing them with the late Beethoven quartets, particularly Opus 132. And trying to nail down some of the techniques that are similar. I remember one is the pairing of the lower strings and the pairing of the upper strings with some material in either, and kind of then suddenly there'll be a flip, and what was in the cello and viola will turn into the first and second fiddle, and the first and second fiddle material will go down. And this is something that's I remember very clearly. Perhaps that my interest in pairing things together is what made that stick. I think the structural ideas of the arch form, unquestionably, were learned from Bartok, and particularly in the fourth and fifth quartet. The kind of motor rhythms that are commented on, particularly in the fourth and fifth, and the kind of dissonant tonal harmony. In Bartok, there is always a key center. It's always fought against. It's very clouded, but it's always there. I think right now, in the work I'm working on right now with the William Carlos Williams setting, is beginning to go back to a more dissonant harmony than I ever have, and is probably closer to that kind of taste that I probably had when I was a student at Juilliard, when I was, if anything, imitating Bartok of that middle period. I think harmonically that's coming back now.
Well, you're drawing a picture of a relationship between past and present that's very interesting and very much worth pursuing, I think. Whether you're doing a paper finding the seeds or the correspondences between Bartok and the late Beethoven quartets, or whether you yourself are going back to finding ideas that work for you in Bach and Bartok and Stravinsky and wherever, you're suggesting a sense of continuity, which is certainly a very valid way of looking at music. I'd like to hear you talk, however, on sort of the other side of the fence. What does it mean to you? What has it meant to you as a composer or as an observer of sort of great forward steps of the past to be progressive, to be innovative, to dare, to what, aside from the pure technique, for example, of putting together a piece like Come Out, one of the earliest pieces and a very surprising piece, what did being that far ahead of what other people of the time were doing suggest to you at the time, or what do you feel about it looking back on it now?
It wasn't a question of being far ahead. It was a question of reverting to type. I had gone through music school, and I either had to, and this is 1963, I got my MA from Mills College, and I had to make some decisions. What am I going to do to stay alive and pay the rent? And I obviously had an opportunity, as most composers in America do, to make application to various universities as a composition theory teacher, and I didn't. And that left open in 1963 precisely nothing in the way of musical employment. So I simply drove a cab. That decision was also based on a kind of discomfort with the kind of composition that was going on in the academic world. And at that period of time, that was predominantly 12-tone and serial music, as exemplified by my teacher, Luciano Berio, but as exemplified by lots and lots and lots and lots of definitely lesser-known and correctly so other academic composers in America. Being someone whose first musical reactions, let's say, of a serious sort were based on music which was tonal, which was rhythmic, it would be unlikely that I would be able to swallow hook, line, and sinker the fruits of Arnold Schoenberg. One can admire, and I did, particularly some of the early pieces, Opus 11, the first two pieces, Opus 19, the middle movement of the five pieces for orchestra, the pieces that everyone knows and loves. And by the way, that's the short list. It gets more problematic from there. Nevertheless, it isn't music that I can really say at any time was ever something that came naturally to me. And indeed, when I wrote 12-tone music, as I've recounted many times, I first introduced the idea of repetition not as a historical move, but merely as a way of sneaking some kind of harmony in the back door. Because if you transpose the row, or if you invert it or put it in retrograde, you are making what is already tonally ambiguous material still more ambiguous. And my idea was to take tonally ambiguous material and try to suggest where that ambiguity might lead, i.e. simply repeat the row over and over again, grouping various notes within the row to create a kind of altered harmony, which Berio noticed and which I noticed. Now, in 1963, a number of other forces came in to influence me, which really, without which I undoubtedly would never have done what I did. And they were all, in a sense, ladders to climb to get back to where I started from in the first place. One of them was John Coltrane, the jazz musician, who at that time was making music with one or two chords. And to study with Berio during the day and hear Coltrane at night was quite an interesting antithesis. Another influence was that in 1962, while I was studying with Berio, the entire class of graduate students trooped down to Ojai in Southern California for a composer's conference where the graduate students get to hear the reigning American masters or international masters, which included Gunther Schuller, I think also Milton Babbitt, Lucas Foss, and Berio. And Schuller was at that time, in 62, writing his history of early jazz. And he, Schuller, said, I wanted to know what black Americans were doing before they came to America, and so I've discovered a book that has, to my knowledge, the only accurate scores of African music that we have. And that book is Studies in African Music by A.M. Jones. So I went back to the Bay Area, went to the Berkeley Library, got the book out, thought it was so important that I actually ordered a copy from Blackwell's in Oxford, and I still, it's right up there. And what I got from that book was something I never could have gotten from recordings of African music, which is, how is it put together? And on one foot, how it's put together is that you have different repeating patterns that are usually subdivisions of 12. They're usually 2-beat, 3-beat, 4-beat, or 6-beat patterns put together so that their downbeats don't coincide. Now, to see this all written down on paper is actually much more of a powerful bit of information than to hear the record where you hear something very exciting rhythmically, but you have no idea what's going on to make that sound. So that was in 1962. A third and certainly pivotal influence was Terry Riley's In C, which I helped put together the first performance of, but indeed that helped coalesce a lot of thoughts of mine. And the result of all of that input, and one other factor that I left out, which is tape loops. Tape loops are little bits of tape where you tape the beginning to the end, and they can be as big as a room and running around with brooms to hold them up, or they can be as small as the capstan of the tape recorder will accommodate, and therefore go around and around rather quickly. And I remember observing them running on two different Wollin sacks once and thinking, little mechanized Africans. And although that's humorous, there's also a teeny bit of truth to it. And with all those influences in the pot, the result in 1960, late 64 and January 65 was It's Gonna Rain, which is the first piece of the phasing technique, and which has the voice of a black preacher, which is perhaps a way of keeping in touch with the fact that I was very, very influenced by jazz much, much earlier on, and then African music was in the back of this. So somehow the purely gut level is a sense of keeping it all of a piece. The techniques certainly are indebted to NC, and they're obviously using tape loops. So it's all pretty much there. Come Out was about a year after, a little bit less than a year after, and it's basically a kind of refinement. It's a much more elegant piece, and it's a much more musical piece in that the kind of C minor, the notes are quite clear, clearer. It doesn't have the kind of rawness that It's Gonna Rain has, but it was time to see if I could get a little bit more conscious in developing exactly where the different phase positions would go. At that time, it was not a historical gesture of saying, well, I'm going to change the history of Western music in my own little way. It was a question of doing something that would really engage me the way 12-tone music would not. I remember the last piece I did at Mills College was a... was a third stream 12-tone piece. You probably remember some of those from the late 50s and early 60s. And it had all the bad earmarks. It's quite a terrible piece, where you have these very tortured kind of lines coming out of an alto saxophone, punctuated by little drum accents, in a kind of sort of strangulated attempt to get the energy that jazz has. But it has this tortured, misplaced set of notes. And I guess I was astute enough to realize that it was terrible, and that whole direction was really not really a musically fertile one. So that really the driving impetus there was a sense of saying, well, why did I become a composer? What am I doing here, in a sense? If this is the way it is, I don't want any part of it. I mean, so to speak, if all there was in music was the music of Arnold Schoenberg and his followers, I would have become... I don't know. I could as happily have stayed driving a taxi or doing many, many other things in the world. I simply wouldn't have become a composer. So it was a personal decision. I think that in time I began to see that, in fact, this was a direction that opened up possibilities for others. And, in fact, it did, Philip Glass being one of them.
Well, you say that you weren't conscious of yourself at that time as, you know, changing the course of Western music. Does your consciousness now, as a senior citizen of minimalism, looking back on it, include ever being aware of other people who consciously or otherwise did do just that? I mean, take the C sharp in the Beethoven or at the beginning of the Beethoven Eroica, or take Monteverdi writing operas on top of 16th century polyphony, or take Wagner and Tristan. Do those figure in any way in your own pantheon?
Monteverdi certainly, I have a hard time with Wagner, and my knowledge and closeness to Beethoven is limited. As I say, I prefer the third movement of 132 to the Eroica, which is really his experiment with the modal writing, and also non vibrato string writing. Monteverdi is someone who didn't do it single-handedly, certainly. As we were discussing earlier on the phone, there was Cipriano de Rore about, 50 years before him, and other lesser-known contemporaries, Caccini, Peri. I think those things are in the air, and what I was doing was in the air, too. It was in popular music. It was in Coltrane. It was in an interest in non-Western music that was growing at a very, very rapid rate in America, in the country that I lived in. And that acceptance of non-Western music was basically tied to certain kinds of tastes to which you could enunciate. It was an interest in music which had less harmonic movement but greater refinement of rhythmic and timbral detail. Now, that kind of sensibility was arising for reasons above and beyond my personal existence, and I was simply a party to that. I was cued into it, let's say, more than those who were simply going on imitating Cage or Berio or what have you. But I certainly didn't originate that. And I believe that the push towards monody in the early 17th century, of which we singled out Monteverdi, is, again, some kind of general zeitgeist thrust of the time, that Monteverdi simply had the talent and the inner kishkas to put together in a way that nobody else could do with his talents. I think there's two ingredients. I think you have to be alive at a time when it's possible to make these historical changes. Number two, you have to have whatever it is that enables you to take that material and really be the person on the inside of you that it was really meant to do that. In other words, it has to somehow just fit one-on-one in your inner sensibility in some very personal way. And without both those ingredients, I don't think that, quote, revolutions and changes are possible. And I think all the ones you've mentioned, I mean, Beethoven's a revolutionary, sure, but, I mean, without Haydn, where would he have been? And Wagner was the heir to the entire, at that point, the entire thrust of German music from Haydn onto himself. Being in America, I think it was easier to be free of those things and to make a kind of a radical move without as much of a sense of historical consciousness as one might have had in Europe at the same time. And also, I think, quote, minimalism, whatever that style is, certainly the music of Terry Riley, myself, Phil Glass, and Lamont Young, is very American in very noticeable ways. Its rhythmic profile, its choice of consonant intervals, its relationship to jazz, various popular non-Western musics that were here at the time. And further proof is that basically in Europe, although there are composers who are writing this style, none of them so far have made a major contribution, because I think that, as I would say the same thing about American serial composers, none of them have made the contribution that Berio, Boulez, or Stockhausen has made, and none of them ever will, because that music is in its guts European music and comes out of a certain time and a place. The time being about 1912 originally, and then later after World War II, and the place being either Vienna or the European continent at large. And I think that the same thing can be said of the kind of music that I do, that it's really something that grew up on American soil for very clear, non-mysterious reasons, and it's been developed by Americans. That will click. The worst is yet to come. The machine will sort of click on, and when it does, you won't hear any voices, but you'll hear a horrendous...
You're at the end of the statement anyhow, which is, yeah. So I might as well
might as well pause for click identification.
You said somewhere a little while back something about there being a time for a revolutionary move. What creates such a time, or what prevents any time from being a time for a revolution?
Well, I don't. I think that 12-tone and serial music was not new when I was discovering it. Basically, what I was sort of born into was the playing out, sense of exit, of atonal non-rhythmic music. I mean, the way I have come to understand is that I feel that there's a movement in German music, particularly. I think this is also important. Starting in Handel and starting in Haydn, and going through Wagner and through Schoenberg, of basically becoming more chromatic and less rhythmic, and that the two are somehow related. That as the chromaticism grows and as the relationship to the key gets less and less clear, so the element of rubato and the gestural aspect of the music grow, and the actual strict tempo disappear until we end up with Mahler, Schoenberg, Wagner. In Schoenberg, of course, this hits a kind of what appeared to be a finale, but it wasn't actually. It was then picked up after the war and taken a step further by Stockhausen, by Boulez, by Berio, by others. They were working in their prime, let's say in the 50s, certainly in the 60s. By the 70s, I would say that this seems to have passed. By the 80s, I think, although people may be writing in this style, it is no longer a current style. In 1963, when I was at a position where I had to make a certain kinds of decisions, I think it was an easier decision to reject that and to fall back on my own resources with the other influences that I mentioned than it might have been in 1946 or 47 after the war, when there was a new kindling of, like, let's really look at what Schoenberg did now that the war is over. That was the time to do what actually happened there at that time. I think that by the time I got to it, and being an American, I think that both those parts of it made it possible to simply be who I was with a little bit more assurance. Although, finally, one never knows those things. You know, one does what one does. I believe this, and it eventually works out or it doesn't. And whether minimalism represents some kind of historical movement of real substance or not will remain to be seen. Certainly within the history of American music, it does. But the relationship between American music and the rest of European music has always been rather complicated.
Can you think of any other kind of new movement, of trend toward new music, that seems to have divided the taste of the world, or at least the taste of the tastemakers, quite as violently as minimalism?
Oh, sure, Cage. When I was going to...
Wait a minute.
Oh, not only that, before that. I mean, when I was first involved as a student, the fight was, are you for Schoenberg or are you for Stravinsky? And then, of course, Stravinsky threw a monkey wrench into that one by writing 12-tone music, and much to his credit as a great genius that he was. Nevertheless, it always sounded like Stravinsky, although after Agon, I don't know. It does get rather problematical. But, I mean, that was a great, during the 30s when I wasn't around, but I know that it divided the music world something terrible. And you were either 12-tone or you were neoclassical or something like that. And it was a real polemical issue. When I was going to school, the arguments between the people who followed Cage and the people who followed Stockhausen, Boulez, Berio, etc., was, or Babbitt and Cage, was a big cause celeb. I frankly thought that was absurd because they both sounded the same. I understood that the methods were quite different, but the actual, and I think Eimert and some other people in Germany wrote similar essays saying that, yes, but the end result ends up being quite the same, which is non-harmonic, non-rhythmic. The details of arriving at those conclusions are different, but the music is astoundingly similar. And therefore, I've always treated Cage as if he was part of that whole movement, although I understand that his personality and his methods are quite different.
Well, what I was referring to, sure, there have been these divisions, but I can't think of a time when they seem to have been played out quite as much in the public arena as the way you pick up in New York Times week after week after week. And Hanahan seems to see a minimalist miasma under the bed at night. Maybe it's because minimal concerts are given at the Bitter End and the Bottom Line, as well as in Town Hall and Carnegie Recital Hall.
Well, I think it's mostly because we're living through it, and we weren't living quite as consciously or as maturely through the other periods. I think what's under our own. I mean, that's my guess. I'm sure that. I know critics thought that Cage was absolutely. I mean, there are critics who still maintain that he is. It's music that's quite different than, particularly if you're tied to the orchestral repertoire, the music between 1750, 1760, and 1900, predominantly in Germany, you're going to have a very hard time with this. One thing we haven't mentioned, but something that I feel I've become increasingly clear of after the fact, is that basically minimalism is in that ever-present dichotomy, is French music. It comes out, it's the American in Paris, 1970s, 1980s. And I have been thinking about a lot of harmonic techniques that I use, question of notes. One in particular that's grown more and more important, which is a similar material that's reharmonized, it stays the same. Similar material in the middle register that gets different bass notes. This is directly one-on-one out of Debussy. C sharp and Afternoon of a Faun. It's the exact identical kind of technique. Now, I think that Americans like myself, or Riley, or Glass, or whatnot, have been exposed to so much Debussy via movie music, via Gershwin, via Keith Jarrett, via bebop, that scholarly or conscious awareness of where those various techniques comes in is almost impossible to get because you're swimming in it. It's like your own language. But I see now that. I think more consciously in terms of what I'm doing in terms of the notes, that they definitely revert back to Debussy and Ravel, and that there is this kind of division, and that what I'm doing reverts to a kind of tradition that came from Debussy to Stravinsky and Bartok and to what we're doing here now.
You suggest an interesting approach to this whole matter of newness, of moving along a different path. The fact that we are as inundated as we are in a musical repertory that goes back to 1750, which was a problem that Beethoven didn't have to face, that Monteverdi didn't have to face.
I mean, no.
These people were writing the music of their own time. Did that make it easier to be different? Or, on the one hand, it should have, because you didn't have the great symphonic Thursday night symphony goers who want their Brahms and their Schubert. But on the other hand, there was no sense of history involved at all, so that everything had to be...
Well, no, there was a sense of history involved. It's just that I think that they were more... The 20th century has been unique in that there isn't... And this is another thing I got from Paul Overton. I think he was right. He used to say, we don't live in a common practice period. Now, common practice, as it's thought of, is the period of figured basses and the late Baroque, early classic period. But in another sense, you could say common practice was almost every time except our time, in that... In those other periods, although people wrote in different styles, the parameters of their similarities were, to our ears, vastly more similar than what you will hear going on simultaneously here in 1983 on in New York, America, and Europe, where you can hear composers writing totally serialized music, people writing quasi-rock and roll, people writing minimal music, people writing music that sounds like it's a rehash of Richard Strauss or Mendelssohn. Now, all those styles are considered particularly au courant, or at least their contemporary style. They are light years away from each other, and there's no period in history outside of the 20th century where that was the case. There was a kind of general agreement, and I think that also is characteristic of the world that we live in, that we don't live in a world where there's any sense of community or social fabric. And also, as Hall Overton said, that's an unfortunate thing. I don't think we're living in a more enlightened time. I think we're living in a very tragic time, in a very potentially final time, obviously. And I don't think that these things are great positive developments. I think that we have no choice but to deal with them the best way we can. But all things considered, it's probably much healthier for a composer to be able to basically say yes to what he's grown up with and to build on that rather than have to sit down and decide the basic language he's going to work in. I mean, that's kind of almost a lunatic position to be in. It's one that we consider quite normal, But historically speaking, it's really very strange.
What you're saying is very much what Boulez told me the first time I ever interviewed him when I was still working on the Times here, that, well, he pointed to 1945, to the end of the World War, as a period in which everybody in his generation felt that the time had come to just draw a line, start all over again from
ground zero. It's very understandable. But they didn't start from ground zero. They started from Ronald Schoenberg and Berg, and particularly Anton Webern. I mean, there's no more historical development than serialism. It's merely a kind of another story on the house that Schoenberg was building, or another wing. I mean, and no one ever said anything different.
And yet they did identify it. They thought of it as ground zero, which is sort of curious. Well, maybe it just meant that, in that sense, Schoenberg was so... He was still not known to the public. I mean, Mary was living in Los Angeles... Los Angeles had never heard anything later than Pelias or the Transfigured Night.
Yeah, I don't think Schoenberg figured in world music before the war the way he figured in world music after the war. And maybe that's what they were referring. I mean, since somebody who grew up after the war, obviously that's the way it appears to me, but I think it would appear that way to most people who were around, because just as he was about to maybe be taken seriously, the war sort of stopped everything, certainly for him.